this session on various aspects of international development or work on the ground with an address from Professor Philip Oxhorn at McGill. Philip is another extremely distinguished contributor to this field of research. He is the founding director of the McGill Institute for the Study of International Development, which has a tremendous reputation. He has significant and extensively recognized expertise in various aspects of social and political sciences related to governments. His particular area of expertise is in Latin America. He is a global figure in the world of development, particularly related to government structures, especially democracy. And I think we are very pleased to be able to welcome Professor Oxhorn here today. Again, it kind of rounds out the session that we've had, various aspects of on-the-ground implementation of development programs, and we're searching. Thanks very much. Welcome, Philip.
It's a pleasure to be here, and what I have to say comes from a somewhat different background. It's not specifically related to health issues, but I think it's very relevant to that, and it reflects the experience that I have as a political scientist who has, in particular, done a lot of work on inclusion in Latin America and the idea of what is civil society, why does it matter. Now, what I want to start with is the idea that we often forget how important perceptions are, that people look at things very differently. And one of the tricks to getting collaboration off the ground is to understand that people look at things not only differently, but to kind of get a sense of what that difference actually means. And so, just as a quick anecdote, a few years ago I was involved in a study of decentralization and citizen participation in the delivery of services in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And the whole thing had been going quite well. It was a working group where people were presenting the case studies from six different countries in three parts of the world. And all of a sudden, two people from Kenya, both Kenyans, one happening to work in Washington at the time, and the other one having flown in from Kenya, mentioned the fact that it is very difficult to organize civil society when there's no state, and they still managed to succeed in delivering services. And there was silence, because the Latin Americans simply couldn't understand what it meant to not have a state and how you can deliver services without a state. And the Kenyans couldn't understand why the Latin Americans couldn't understand, and I couldn't understand, and my colleagues who were on the organizing committee couldn't understand why no one could understand each other. And it literally took us 10 minutes to realize that from the perspective of these different people, some of whom included, one of whom was actually a recent Berkeley PhD from Mexico, they simply couldn't understand what it meant to have a state that was different from the one that they had known. And these are the kinds of challenges that any kind of collaboration between what I'll call the global north and the global south necessarily have to address. Another problem of perceptions is whose agenda is it? And I think a very pertinent example is actually from the work of Jeffrey Sachs. We'll call him the young Jeffrey Sachs before he learned better. One of the first interventions that he made in the world of macroeconomic policymaking was actually in Bolivia in the mid-80s. And what he did literally was he flew into La Paz and spent a day and a half in a hotel room in La Paz and redid the whole budget for Bolivia. Now, that just shows you how much we've advanced technologically. Now he could have done it from his office in New York. It also shows you how far Jeffrey Sachs has gone in terms of what he has learned. And the point is that right from the get-go, that whole set of policies was tainted. Why? Because he didn't leave his Bolivian hotel room, and he didn't leave his Bolivian hotel room because he didn't speak Spanish, which also meant that he didn't talk to any Bolivian economists, much less Bolivian professionals. And what ended up happening was the idea that whatever he had done, however effective it was imposed. And so this is the beginning of that bogeyman of the current period, neoliberalism. Now, why is that a problem? Well, first of all, at the time, the reason that Sachs was brought in was because Bolivia was experiencing hyperinflation, which in a nutshell means that prices in the morning are noticeably higher by the time the store closes in the afternoon. And as we know, this affects poor people and elderly on fixed incomes more than anybody else. It's extremely regressive. And what his policies did, for better or for worse, is they solved that problem. which automatically goes very far to addressing inequity and inequality issues, and basically eliminates the inflationary tax, which is an overwhelming burden on the poor. But because of the way it was done, it was tainted. Because of the way it was done, it did more than just resolve problems of hyperinflation. And because of the way it was done, it generated a political dynamic that led to tremendous and growing amounts of instability that are still working themselves out today, over 20 years later. Now, part of these perceptions also comes from a real problem in development work, which is accountable to whose citizens. On the one hand, we have northern taxpayers or other northerners, the people with the money who fund the foundations, who make the taxes that allow for Canadian International Development Agency projects to go through, over Canada's donations to the multilateral and bilateral organizations to which it contributes. Now, obviously, since we pay taxes, we have a right to understand and know how that money is being spent. So this accountability issue, however exaggerated it may be in practice, is something you can't avoid. But conversely, what about accountability to the communities in need? And part of the challenge of collaboration is getting the mix right, trying to find out a way in which accountability to the north and accountability to the south can meet in some way so that everybody benefits, so that tax money is not wasted, so that the consequences of that tax money actually improve the quality of life of the people we're trying to help. Now, another element of this idea of perceptions matter is more general, and it's whose research questions. And this is very, very important because what it really underlies is the idea that good intentions are not good enough. In other words, we need to ask research questions that reflect two things in particular. One is the priorities that the people who are supposedly going to benefit from this research think are appropriate. But more fundamentally, it has to be open-ended in a way that recognizes that people ask the same questions differently, or because of their own perceptions, they may come at the same problem with different questions. Another example, this was a recent PhD from Columbia University, and his only saving grace was that he was from Mexico. Because what did he do? In a workshop very similar to this one, sponsored by IDRC and the Carnegie Foundation, on North-South collaboration. And what he said is that, without realizing it at the time, is that there's one way to do science, that it's teleological if not linear, and he went through a series of assumptions that he took for granted. Now, everybody in the room was up in arms, and the poor guy was quite shocked because he didn't realize what he said was controversial. And the reason it was controversial wasn't that he was wrong, is that his research questions were just one way of getting at the same problem. And these kinds of misunderstandings that reflect different perceptions are things that we confront whenever we try to do collaborative research. And I think we can see many of the examples of that from the previous two discussions. In a project that I'll talk about in a minute, one that looks at the relationship between peace and development, we had a workshop involving people from all over the world, north and south, east and west, and what we quickly realized is that there were at least five different definitions of political economy, ranging from Karl Marx on the left to Milton Friedman on the right and a variety in the middle. And so the problem of research questions is often very fundamental and leads to misunderstandings that I think often are just not only not useful, but not necessary. Now, basically, and this is what I'll be talking about during the rest of my time, the goal that I think collaborative research needs to address is we need to lay a foundation so that the collaboration is real, authentic, or genuine, and not something that's artificial or whose legitimacy is challenged from the get-go. Now, as a beginning, and this is something that we try through the institute that I direct to put into practice with more or less success depending upon the case and the day, is we need to recognize the different comparative advantages, again, of the global north and the global south. And by comparative advantages, I mean, well, what is it that the north or the south can uniquely bring to the table as a basis for understanding where collaboration can be most productive and can be most genuine? Now, very generally, very broadly speaking, the North's comparative advantage is resources. I mean, let's face it, you would only see a conference with this impressive audience, with this breadth of expertise, either in North America or funded by North Americans or Europeans. And that's very, very important because it means that the North is able to bring a breadth of expertise that requires a lot of money. And so, for example, in a political science department, which is where I would be normally based, it's only in the universities of Canada, of the United States, of Europe, that you'll get a broad range of area expertise, so that someone working on China can speak to somebody working on Latin America, who could speak to somebody who actually knows something about Canada or North America. And this takes a lot of money and a lot of resources. Similarly, those resources mean that the collective global North has real and unavoidable advantages in information technologies. We have bigger, better libraries. We have the funds to amass and collect and then interpret databases. We have the computational and other IT technologies that allow us to maximize the benefits of those databases. Now, when we look at the global South, there are very important comparative advantages that we also need to recognize. One is the depth of expertise. So as somebody who lives in Latin America, my advantage is that I was trained by people who know about many different countries in Latin America. I benefited from the breadth of expertise. But when I go to Chile or Mexico or Bolivia, I cannot really claim or pretend to understand any of those countries nearly as well as the people who were trained and born there, for the obvious reasons that this is their reality, and it's a reality that I'm trying to know from afar, even though I'm physically there and I can speak quite good Spanish. But another advantage, and I think this is the one that's the hardest to get a handle on, but in many ways it's the most important, is the idea that maybe there's a unique perspective that the collective South might have to offer. And again, this is based on perceptions and very different experiences. Okay, Canada was a colony, but it was never a colony the same way that Brazil, the same way that Kenya was, the same way that many other countries in the South were. The colonial legacies, both negative and in particular negative, but positive as well, were very, very different in the South. That affects the ways in which people who grow up in these environments and are trained and taught in these environments approach the world that we live in. And it's something that we need to not only respect, but I think take advantage of. I think part of what Richard Gold was talking about and the difficulties of dealing with indigenous groups, and this is something that's true for indigenous groups all over the world, whether it's in Canada up north or in the Brazilian jungles of the Amazon, is that their unique experiences contribute to unique perspective that gives insights that we have to learn to appreciate because they don't come naturally to us. Now, ultimately, what this understanding of comparative advantages is intended to contribute to is the importance of ensuring that development policies reflect recipient needs and priorities. I mean, this seems like a no-brainer. Obviously, we are investing and working and dealing with the problems of developing countries because we care, because we assume that our interventions will be good, because we presume that they will address needs, and we hope that they'll address the priorities of the people that are the recipients. But in practice, it doesn't always work out that way. And again, good intentions are never enough. And the way to do that, and what our efforts at collaboration deliberately seek to do, are several things to lay that foundation. The first is consultation and networking. I mean, we know in our own everyday lives that networking is really, really important. And we have to remember that it's just as important, and in some ways even more important, that those networks and those consultations include the partners or the potential partners that we may find in the global South. That's how we can begin to appreciate their comparative advantages, to appreciate their different perceptions, and to take advantage of that uniqueness so that our policies will be, again, those that are appropriate in accordance with their needs and their priorities. Because that's, after all, the point, isn't it? Second of all, and again, this echoes some of the things that the other speakers had mentioned, what we need to do to build the foundations for this kind of collaboration is strengthening research capacity in southern countries. And again, this again reflects the resources imbalances. What this includes or should include, ideally, is graduate and postdoctoral fellowships so that people from the global south can have an experience in the global north, take advantage of our expertise or the breadth of our expertise, and then take that back home with them. Similarly, it doesn't end just with graduate students and postdocs. It also includes visiting research professorships for more senior people so that they can become acquainted not only with what's up-to-date, cutting-edge here, but also who we are, which really underlines what we often forget, that by building research capacity in an appropriate way, we're also strengthening networks, we're also increasing our ties and our abilities to work with and understand the people that we want to work with and we want to understand. Now, the third thing in this regard, too, is that we also have to remember, and I think we're increasingly appreciating the importance of this, the need to train our own students in ways that will make them open to this kind of collaboration, this kind of networking, this kind of understanding. And I'm very happy to say that in our experience, our own students oftentimes appreciate this more than we might, or certainly than perhaps we did when we were their age. We do this through internships, we do this through research and study in the South, including them in our own networks, making sure that they are open, because of their own experiences, to very, very different realities. Now, what I want to do I think I have like 5 or 6 minutes left, is just talk about two examples of how ISID ISID is trying to put this into practice. The first, and both of these are relatively new and ongoing, the first is a resident fellows program in democratic governance. Now, this project is funded by the Canadian International Development Agency, and it was developed through active collaboration between CETA and the predecessor of ISID, the Center for Developing Area Studies. And the goal behind this whole project would be that Southern researchers would actually work with CETA program officers both here and in their home countries in order to assist CETA and similar donor agencies in meeting their own assistance objectives. More specifically, what we're going to do, they'll be arriving in July, is we're bringing a researcher from Bolivia who has extensive experience in studying and working with the Bolivian government in areas relating to citizen participation and decentralization, and a Peruvian fellow, a woman who has had extensive work working with human rights organizations in both the NGO sector and in the government sector in Peru. They'll be coming to McGill to work with McGill faculty and researchers who have similar and shared interests, but also to interface with CETA officials here in Canada. But before they come, what they're doing right now as we speak, because we only nominated them 3 weeks ago and the fellowships began as of May 1st, what they're doing now is they're on the ground working with CETA program officers in Bolivia and in Peru, networking and talking with other experts in Bolivia and in Peru to understand what specific priorities could mean. And the goal, again, is to find a happy marriage between the priorities and goals of Peru and Bolivia, respectively, and the priorities and goals of CETA, specifically. And then they'll be coming to McGill for 6 months, beginning in July, where they'll continue this interaction, but now with CETA officials in Ottawa. The other thing that's important, too, to emphasize here is that we've made provisions for a very important role for graduate students. And so research assistants will be hired in Montreal to work directly with both fellows. But at the same time, we were careful to ensure that research assistants would be hired in Bolivia and in Peru to assist the fellows and the CETA program officers with that important aspect of the project. Now, the second program that I want to talk about is a project that recently began. It's called Peace and Development, Democratization, Poverty Reduction, and Risk Mitigation in Fragile and Post-Conflict States. And the starting point for the whole project is the very common assumption in policy-making circles and academic circles, which is that positive developmental outcomes are mutually reinforcing. In other words, all good things come together, and we don't have to worry about trade-offs or even setting priorities necessarily. And so what's getting the project going is that we will test that assumption. Is it true? You know, are poverty reduction, risk mitigation, and democratization compatible in post-conflict settings in the long and or short term? It's a project that's funded by the International Development Research Center and the World Bank. Now, in order to get a handle on this, because obviously the topic is tremendously large, we focused on three sets of related issues which should be relevant to understanding the prospects for achieving peace, development, and democracy. The first is participatory governance and service provision. The idea is, does it make a difference how services are provided and whether or not citizens play a direct role in that? The literature and the experience is quite divided. Second of all, power sharing for peace building and development. In other words, are the power-sharing agreements that we need to make today to ensure peace going to be favorable towards longer-term developmental goals, which may reflect very, very different sets of criteria? And, of course, what are those criteria? And third, what should be the economic agenda for post-conflict reconstruction? Do we worry about inflation? Do we worry about balance of payments? What do we worry about and why? Now, these issues are addressed in two component parts. On the one hand, a series of thematic essays that assess aggregate global trends, i.e. the North's comparative advantage, has been commissioned by ISID and the World Bank. The second component is seven in-depth case studies, the South's comparative advantage. The countries are Bosnia, Colombia, Lebanon, Mozambique, Rwanda, Sri Lanka, and Sudan, reflecting a wide range of outcomes in terms of conflict. Obviously, Sudan is in the midst of a conflict. Rwanda and Bosnia have long left the conflict behind, but in very, very different ways. Sri Lanka may be on the verge of something, but so far it's a very intense conflict, and of course the other three countries in the middle. Second of all, these case studies are done by multidisciplinary teams in country. So for Bosnia, we have an economist and a political scientist. Colombia, we have a sociologist and an economist. But they're Colombians, they're Bosnians, they're in country. They're people that, again, reflect what I call the South's comparative advantage. Now, the challenge here is integrating these two components, especially when they can't even agree on something that should be as simple as political economy definitions. And we've done this basically with the idea that case studies would inform the development of macro-level theory. In other words, the theories and the ideas that come out of the thematic papers will be directly challenged by people who have a very different experience and very different perspectives stemming from their own country's recent past. But at the same time, to make this manageable, to ensure coherence and some level of comparability from the findings, that theory remains the foundation for the overall study. In the end, what we hope to have are better case studies and better theories that will allow us to better understand what kinds of policies are necessary to deliver services, to ensure conflicts don't reignite, and more generally, to ensure an appropriate economic environment, which is what Sachs tried to do, but screwed it up because he didn't collaborate. Now, in the 30 seconds I probably have left, or I'm going to take, just some quick conclusions. The first is long-term horizons. If you can do it in a weekend, the odds are it's not going to work. What this means is you need to recognize that building relationships takes time and efforts. It needs to be done with donors, but just as importantly, it needs to be done with southern researchers. We'll assume for now that the northern researchers can get along, but of course we know that's easier said than done as well. Similarly, the expectations that we have need to reflect that. In other words, when we want to involve ourselves in collaborations, we have to recognize that certain things are only possible in the long term, but we need to have short-term outcomes, in particular, to solve that accountability problem vis-a-vis taxpayers. And the idea is to make sure that they're achievable, clearly defined, and that what we do today won't undermine what we want to do in the future. Second general point, we need to collaborate as equals with different areas of experience and different areas of expertise, recognizing those differences in a positive way so that we might learn something from that, with the last thing I'll say, the ultimate goal of achieving better policy outcomes in terms of effectiveness and relevance for the people who are supposed to be benefiting from them. Thank you.